Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Into the Night was made possible by the unwavering support of our dedicated Patreon donors. Their generosity allows us to delve deeper into the mysteries that await us in the dark world of Five Nights at Freddy's. If you're captivated by the secrets we unveil and wish to be part of our journey, we invite you to explore our Patreon page. By becoming a patron, you not only gain exclusive access to bonus content, behind-the-scenes insights, and special perks, but you also play a vital role in sustaining the future of this podcast. Visit the link provided in the description below to learn more and join the Night Conclave. Hello. And welcome to Shadow Scrying, the official sister series of the Into the Night podcast. As always, I am your host, Nick. And thank you for listening. Well, surprise, surprise. Didn't expect me coming back so soon to the world of the Tales of the Pizzaplex, now did ya? Yeah, well, originally I had wanted to end the discussion of the Tales book series with B7-2. I think out of all the episodes I had done on Tales of the Pizzaplex, that was my absolute favorite to make. But then I stopped to consider how, moving forward, it would probably be best to have a condensed and clerical view of the novellas. So then the idea of a tier list episode centered around the Tales books came to fruition, a celebration and final discussion surrounding the entire series to give them one last send-off and ranking them based off which were the most enthralling experiences, in my opinion. But then it hit me. I never had an episode on the first ever Tales novella collection. I briefly discussed it when I covered the second book in the series, but I don't think that truly gives the first ever venture its fair shake. Long story short, I want to talk about the first ever Tales book in depth, because I never truly did so. Plus, I can't deny that I am curious to look back on the first ever novella collection in the series now that the Tales trek reached its conclusion, with a wealth of stories to contrast and compare the first entry to. I'm not gonna lie, I kind of forgot how innocuous the first troop of stories was, especially in comparison to the first ever Fazbear Frights Into the Pit. That book had Spring Bonnie Demons, a Circus Baby equivalent, and just straight up fun time Freddy. Meanwhile, Tales number 1 Lally's Game doesn't really have much of a robust and voguish roster. Lally's Game text contains, in order, Frailty, a book that feels almost like a black sheep in Tales as a leftover Fazbear Fright sequel. Lally's Game, a story in which it takes place not just outside of the Pizzaplex, but after the Pizzaplex has been abandoned and under construction. A bizarre story that is the most connective to the Five Nights at Freddy's universe, yet takes it into a much more surreal state, if you can believe that. That is the best way to describe Lally's Game, I believe. Surreal. So many of the esoteric forces behind these stories are all their own unique flavor of disturbing. Whether it be the unknowable forces of the supernatural, the incomprehensibility of science and technology beyond human understanding, or just simply the unpredictability of madness in chaos itself, which is the theme of Lally's Game, the unknown, and being in between two states. To better articulate, there's almost a symbolic link to a concept similar to that of Schrodinger's cat within every story. For those who do not know Schrodinger's cat, it is a famous thought experiment developed by Austrian physicist Erwin Schrodinger that demonstrates the idea in quantum physics that tiny particles can be in two states at once until they are observed. To elucidate, Schrodinger's original formulation, a cat, a flask of poison, and a radioactive source are placed in a sealed box. If a Geiger counter detects radioactivity, the flask will eventually shatter, releasing the poison, which will then inevitably kill the cat. When one looks in the box, One sees the cat is either alive or dead, but until that box is opened, both possibilities have to be considered equally true, if done under a quantum physical lens. This poses the question of when exactly quantum superposition ends and reality resolves into one possibility or the other. The point, as Schrodinger wrote, was that this, quote, ridiculous scenario should discourage us from naively accepting as valid a blurred model of reality. Effectively, be wary of holding truth that is paradoxical in nature, and, as we will soon discuss, this blurred reality is what ends up being the hellish nightmare that all our characters will endure and eventually succumb to. For if you are not working with the truth, you are operating in a life of falsehoods. Before we dive into it, though, I do want to warn that, unlike most episodes of Shadow Scrying, this episode will not be spoiler-free. This is not a first impression review. This is a more in-depth discussion of the books with the foresight of the future installments that follow this series. So if you do not wish to be spoiled, my original first impressions, which are spoiler-free, can be found in the Tales of the Pizza Plex number 2 episode, Haps. So please, be wary, you have been warned. Alright, let's begin with possibly one of the most controversial stories within the theorist community. Frailty.
That's my character! I'm the trash man! I come out, I throw trash all over the ring, and then I start eating garbage!
Our first novella, Frailty, opens with a man named Jack, an experienced EMT and his partner Dave in a dire situation. Caught in a tumultuous storm, they attempt to resuscitate a teenage boy who crashed his car in the raging rain, colliding with a tree near a cemetery. Despite their valiant efforts, their attempts prove futile. The boy was already lost before they got there. As Jack prepares to depart, packing up his tools and getting the stretcher out of the back of the ambulance, he becomes startled by some peculiar noises emanating from behind him. To his astonishment, he finds a diminutive, slender figure hovering over the boy's lifeless body, like an apparent shadow hovering over the boy. The figure's movements catch Jack's attention, particularly when he notices it wielding a knife, stroking it back and forth, grinding it on something. Hey! Reacting swiftly, Jack yells at the figure, causing it to retreat hastily. The officer on the scene rushes over, and when Jack reports what he saw, the officer replies he didn't hear anything, and that it must have just been the shadows in the rain playing tricks on Jack. And just when Jack was about to agree with him, after all, the idea of a long, slender shadow sneaking around a graveyard was already ludicrous, the boy he just declared dead began to wake up. The identity of this mysterious silhouette is in actuality a 14-year-old girl named Jessica, employed as a janitor in the children's wing of a hospital, and an outsider in her school. Her choice of occupation serves a higher purpose, however, as she chooses to spend her time in the hospital on a much more noble goal: healing others. The reason why Jessica was able to help the boy in the car crash, as opposed to the trained EMTs, was because she possessed a unique ability, or rather, an esoteric accessory. Around her neck, she wore a silver heart-shaped pendant, and by scraping silver from this pendant and transferring it onto another person, she could resuscitate their health, extending it even further. If she scraped larger chunks off this necklace away, she could bring the recently deceased back to life. However, all magic comes with a price. For the necklace that Jessica used to resuscitate the dead, always took a piece of her away whenever she scraped the silver. Before she acquired this pendant, she used to be a typical girl, yearning for fashionable attire, popularity, and romance. She wanted to be lovely, to be beautiful. Jessica's life, however, took an unforeseen turn after she made a fateful misstep. Okay, let's stop dissecting this all right now, because if you are familiar with the past Finding Freddy's literature, you will recognize this bears striking similarities to another story from the FNAF universe, but not specifically Tales. Instead, Frailty has a strange connection to the Fazbear Fright novella, To Be Beautiful. The main protagonist makes a choice to become more desirable by focusing on what makes someone lovely on the outside at the cost of what made her on the inside. The use of the heart-shaped silver pendant with seemingly supernatural powers is the exact same pendant used in the story, and the list of similarities just keeps getting added onto as the story progresses. The only two similarities, not parallels, that do not exist, however, are the names of the protagonist and the school they go to. Despite frailty, by all metrics of how it's written and how it's presented, seems like a sequel of To Be Beautiful, it isn't. It's its own thing. And this hasn't gone unnoticed from the larger FNAF community. In fact, this one story is the reason why so many argue that Fazbear Frights has to be canon due to its connective tissue with To Be Beautiful, and by extension, how Fazbear Frights and Tales are both canon to the game timeline. As many, including myself, argue that the Tales books make an implicit choice in their wording, lore, and revisions to make it clear that both medias exist in the same continuity, those medias being the Tales series and the games. Now, if we were to take the utmost cynical route, we could just leave this as the writer simply reusing ideas. But on a less cynical perception, we can probably find a more generous middle ground with the concept of Frailty being a sequel to To Be Beautiful that was never finished or simply didn't make the cut for Fazbear Frights. But when Tales were being developed, the story finally met Scott's approval, and he decided to include it with the caveat of certain alterations being made to differentiate both stories. It would explain why this story has the least connective tissue to the Freddy Fazbear's Mega Pizzaplex, only briefly mentioning it by one of the parents in the hospital. That is seriously the only facet of this story that would alert a reader that this is taking place in the world of Five Nights at Freddy's. Do I think that's the answer? I can't say it isn't hypothetical, and it doesn't answer a lot. But I'm also not sure if it's that simple. That being said, I don't believe the other extreme either, that this story is supposed to be used as Scott communicating to the audience that Fazbear Frights are indeed canon. After all, using other entries in the tales like GGY, Help Wanted, or Dittophobia, these stories also use elements of previous FNAF canon, but also makes a pretty large distinction that it isn't just using him, it's expanding on them. GGY makes it very clear that this is the backstory for Gregory, the same Gregory we see in Security Breach. Help Wanted matches with the lore we know of the developer of the fake FNAF games we learn about in the game Help Wanted, but discloses that Fazbear Entertainment had a much more nefarious hand in that project than originally portrayed. And Dittophobia utilizes an almost one-to-one description of the FNAF 4 environment and elements of Citrification to articulate that the stories and their settings are connected. The silver pendant that Jessica has, its powers, and her overall identity and backstory do line up with Sarah and Eleanor from To Be Beautiful. But unlike other entries in the Tales stories, it doesn't really make as much of an effort to bridge the two worlds, let alone bridge all three. So with this in mind, I believe the best way to look at this story and its elements in conjunction with To Be Beautiful is to utilize it as a basis and how Frailty expands upon it. Jessica continued to attend school, albeit with the intention of avoiding suspicion rather than trying to find genuine engagement. While she maintained her cover exceptionally well at school, with most only noticing her shy behavior and her frail physique, her demeanor and kind of fragile behavior didn't skip the notice of the hospital staff. In particular, the head nurse of the youth wing of the hospital, Nurse Macy, was always concerned with her home life and well-being. She hoped everything was okay, but whenever she attempted to get to know more about Jessica, she was always shunned away. That, and she was also too preoccupied with the mysterious collection of silver dust and small pieces of rusted metal that would crop up spontaneously in the children's wing. Unexpectedly, Jessica's solitary existence was interrupted when she found herself partnered with a new student, Robert, for a robotics project. To her surprise, unlike the rest of the student body, Robert treated her with kindness and respect, a stark contrast to the constant harassment she endured from her peers due to her fragile physical state. This unexpected gesture of empathy left Jessica both astonished and deeply moved, sparking a glimmer of hope amidst her solitude. As Jessica and Robert collaborate on their mini-bot 5000 project, their friendship blossoms with a hint of a romantic attraction between the two. Eventually, Robert even asks Jessica out to their school prom. Jessica had never felt so alive, but she had also never felt so scummy. She was losing sight on her second chance to heal others and putting her own priorities ahead of her mission. The day before the prom, she decides to think about her life in the hospital chapel. She feels distraught and confused over what she wants and what she needs to do. The chapel's preacher, Father Jeremiah, walks in and notices Jessica appearing conflicted and disoriented, and offers his ear if she needs someone to talk to. Jessica opens up about her goal and a bit about her past, to help others and to redeem herself from a bad choice she made in the past, although keeps the specific details of the events to herself, but feels guilty that she is now trying to get some of her old life back. Father Jeremiah, while acknowledging that she isn't telling him the whole story, emphasizes the importance of balancing altruism with self-care to Jessica and encourages her to take this moment for herself. Jessica agrees and goes to tell Robert that she will accept his invitation to prom. And as she departs, Father Jeremiah, happy to see Jessica with a more positive expression on her face, hits his foot on a small gear left behind in Jessica's wake. Jessica goes to confide in Nurse Macy about her nerves regarding her upcoming prom date, prompting Macy to offer her assistance in finding the perfect dress. The two forge a strong bond as they select a beautiful lilac dress together. However, Nurse Macy's concern for Jessica's well-being deepens after a brief discussion with Father Jeremiah after Jessica leaves her. He reveals the details of their conversation regarding her mission, her need to be redeemed, and some tragedy in her past. Nurse Macy, now greatly concerned for Jessica's well-being, decides to visit her at the address listed on her work application, only to discover that it is fake. On the day of prom, Jessica decides to visit a girl she had been keeping an eye on during her last shift at the hospital, a small girl named April. April wasn't scared, however. She had seen Jessica before, and the nurses told her about Jessica and how kind she was. In fact, she found Jessica a calming presence. As Jessica tells her tale about her life, April imagines herself well again through her stories. Although Jessica considers using her pen to heal April right now, she ultimately decides to keep it to attend prom. However, April's health deteriorates briefly as she begins to leave, weighing heavy on Jessica's conscience, but she pushes it aside so she can have her happiest day. At prom, Jessica is having the time of her life. She's dancing with Robert, and she feels for the first time as beautiful and wonderful as she could be, the way she always wanted to feel. Jessica even entertains the thoughts of forgiveness and happiness for herself, that perhaps she could stay and find more moments like this if she keeps her pendant. However, her hopes are dashed when she attempts to kiss Robert, resulting in grease appearing on him. Robert is disgusted, begins to spit out the grease from his mouth. Shocked stares and laughter come from their peers. Jessica, overwhelmed with feelings of guilt and unworthiness, and now leaking substances from underneath her dress, leaves the prom, convinced this moment proves that she doesn't deserve happiness at all. Jessica returns to the hospital, interrupting a conversation between Nurse Macy and April's doctor, Colin. As she runs by, they notice brown liquid streaks down her face, accompanied by falling metal parts behind her. They call to Jessica as she sprints by, but she ignores her call, enters April's room, and locks the door behind her, and retrieves her pendant and knife. Nurse Macy attempts to open the door while Colin calls for security. Father Jeremiah arrives as well, with security, but by then, Nurse Macy was finally able to unlock the door. only to find a pile of metal pieces drenched in smelly grease in the corner. Everyone is left confused. Macy thinks that Jessica may have escaped somehow, but this is the only doorway in, and she notices the windows are locked. Father Jeremiah begins to pray, directed toward the pile of scrap, clearly grasping something that Macy wasn't. Suddenly, everyone's breath goes silent at the sound of April's heart monitor, registering a strong and healthy beat. So, with the story ending on somewhat of a bittersweet note, what are the takeaways and my overall thoughts on the book? Well, to focus on the latter, I was really happy with the storytelling of the novella. After enduring the onslaught that was the dawning era of the Fazbear Fright series, Frailty was a breath of fresh air with how down-to-earth the story was and how it toned down the supernatural in a manner more familiar with the world of Five Nights at Freddy's. The acceptance of supernatural elements in storytelling often hinges on how well they are integrated into the narrative and supported by the characters and plot. For instance, Michael's resurrection in the narrative of the Fazbear universe is not merely a fantastical occurrence. It is intrinsically tied to his character arc and the overarching story. This integration allows such feats to feel organic and plausible within the established framework of the world, enhances the audience immersion and engagement with the story. Simply presenting such feats without proper narrative support risk it feeling disconnected and arbitrary, undermining the audience's suspension of disbelief. It's essential to ensure that supernatural elements are not introduced haphazardly, but rather serve a purpose within the larger context of the narrative, enriching the storytelling experience for the audience. Jessica's altruistic mission and desire to heal others at the expense of herself was quite endearing, and really made me curious to learn more about her past, as the story leaves her backstory pretty vague. We never quite learn where she got that magic pendant from, but we can assume it is similar in properties to that of the heart-shaped pendant found in the Fazbear Fright novella. The history of that pendant goes as follows. It was created by a scientist named Dr. Talbert. He was consumed by worry for his sick daughter Renelle, so he created a pendant infused with a remnant, hoping to preserve the precious memories of her. But miraculously, Renelle's health improved, and Dr. Talbert intended to gift her the pendant as a symbol of their shared triumph over adversity. However, tragedy struck when Dr. Talbert's wife passed away, plunging both father and daughter into profound grief, and amidst their turmoil, Renelle was expelled from their home, and she took the pendant with her. As Dr. Talbert delved deeper into his research on Remnant, he unwittingly attracted the attention of a creature named Eleanor, an animatronic harboring malevolent energy. Whether through misfortune or malice, Renelle either lost the pendant or was stolen by Eleanor, and empowered by the pendant's remnant-infused capabilities, Eleanor unleashed chaos and havoc upon the world. Remnant has perpetually remained intangible and ethereal within the FNAF universe. The most physical has ever been shown to be is a substance ominously nebulous as a liquid mercury. It embodies an elusive aura, or intangible energy, permeating objects, environments, and occasionally individuals, inducing fluctuations in reality within its sphere of influence. This nebulous quality is also adhered to by Agony, but with the opposite effects. It's important to note, this pendant stands out as the singular object created entirely from Remnant in a solid form, distinguishing it as a unique artifact within the FNAF universe. Moreover, the narrative, while not making an evident effort, effectively highlights the contrasting nature of Remnant and Agony. Frailty portrays Remnant as energy associated with positivity, such as life, order, and healing, contrasting Agony, which typically embodies negativity, symbolizing death, chaos, and corruption. Our insights into the capabilities of Remnant primarily stem from William Afton's experiments, particularly those depicted in such a location. However, a crucial aspect often overlooked in that game is that William's experiments have the primary goal of successfully manipulating Remnant during his experiments, with the secondary goal being the production of the suffering of innocence. When recalling the experiments of Sister Location, most tend to focus on William's secondary goal. However, his goal and method of manipulating and corrupting objects possessed by Remnant are what adds a layer to the FNAF mythos, but is also what causes some level of confusion when it comes to the perceived characterization from the audience. In particular, between characters who are inherently creatures of Remnant and those whose Remnant have been manipulated. This is an important caveat because this is distinguishing why characters like Michael and Charlotte can keep their sanity and their altruistic behaviors, whereas other animatronics like the Fun Times become insane beings of chaos. Jessica's backstory suggests that her acquisition of the pendant, whether through receiving it, selling her soul for it, or obtaining it through some other means, led to the destruction of her original body. As a result, her soul became bound to the pendant. This pendant was able to manipulate inanimate objects enough to create an elusive effect to appear as her original self, albeit with the visage of her being presented as a disfigured and weak soul, most likely not as a result of the pendant's power, nor Jessica's original form, but instead a reflection of Jessica's own mindset of herself. I know that the word parallel gets tossed around a lot in the FNAF theorist community, and it gets tossed around quite incorrectly most of the time, but I truly think this story is supposed to be a parallel to Agents of Remnant that we see throughout the series, and this is a story that illustrates the basis for how these agents act and how we as the audience should perceive them. I mean, Jessica sacrificing herself and hiding in the shadows to conceal her true nature so that innocent children can be saved sounds awfully familiar to another protagonist in the FNAF series, doesn't it? Alternatively, this could also be a way for us to visualize a certain event in the series that has always been presented in a symbolic 8-bit format. Could it be possible, similar to how Charlotte's soul was attached to the marionette when she died, that this was in some capacity how Charlotte was able to give the gift of life, not by scraping off the silver of a heart made out of Remnant, no, but what of the symbolic gesture of it? Consider this, Remnant and Agony are elements that can be simplified in the novels as soul energy, or the power of a human soul and its lingering effect on the immediate environment and the world. Perhaps, in a manner of speaking, the reason why Charlotte can bestow the gift of life to the surrounding animatronics has less to do with the specific power or attribute that she has, but instead, an action she is only willing to do because of her nature.
My daughter, if you can hear me, it's in your nature to protect the innocent. I'm sorry that on that day, the day you were shut out and left to die, no one was there to lift you up into their arms the way you lifted others into yours. It's time to rest for you and for those you have carried in your arms.
As the story progresses, we see the more Jessica gives of herself through the pendant, the more fragile and less convincing her disguise becomes. Perhaps the manner in which Charlie is able to support the innocent spirits of the MCI and place them in their mechanical cradles is that she gives up a part of herself in order to allow the children their second chance in life. The cost is her own vitality as a result, which could extend further as to why she is also susceptible to various defense measures set up by both Fazbear Entertainment and even her father, Henry. With how powerful the marionette is, it is strange that both a music box can keep it content and place it in a tranquil state, and the lefty animatronic can keep her contained. Now that's just a theory, but it is an interesting way of interpreting those events and gives Charlotte that more altruistic motive that Henry claims she has. But if I were to bet dollars to donuts, I would probably guess the former is most likely the real purpose and inspiration for the story. Scott wanted to use an object be heavily associated with beings and Remnant and further illustrate in contrast what Remnant is to its counterparts in Agony, since it can be a bit confusing given how similar their powers and effects are to the narrative of an altruistic being. Huh. You know, maybe I should do a Stratoscrying episode on that one day. I'm gonna write that down.
I am not crazy!
Our next story is the titular Lally's Game, which also serves as our Fazbear Fright equivalent, and an interesting story in terms of time period. We begin with a young couple named Selena and Cade, settling into an old farmhouse in Cade's hometown to care for his 70-year-old mother, Janice. With their wedding just weeks away, they're both thrilled and elated to start this next chapter of their lives together. While overseeing the mover, Selena notices an old, dirty trunk being carried in, which belonged to Cade. Curious, she approaches to inspect it, but Cade intervenes, moving her away quickly. Surprised by his reaction, Selena questions him about its contents, but Cade only vaguely mentions it holds items from his childhood. Cade, being somewhat traditional in his ways, also suggests Selena stay with his mother while they get moved in until they're officially married, offering her his childhood bedroom as her temporary residence. She accepts only because she is a bit curious about Cade's childhood. He talks about his college days, his job, his family, and his modern life, but never his childhood. As Selena sifts through his stuff, she finds an old photo album of his. She begins to peruse the snapshots, and the images start off innocuous enough, depicting typical family moments from Cade's childhood. Graduation, first birthday party, etc. However, her interest deepens when she stumbles upon snapshots of Cade's childhood visits to the Freddy Fazbear Pizzaplex. In particular, she notices numerous pictures of him enjoying various attractions, including posing with Glamrock Freddy. Strangely, however, a significant portion of the photos are set in a blacklight arena called Lally's Game. Okay, let's pause here for a minute and appreciate this paragraph of information. Did anyone else just realize that this story is the furthest moment we currently have in the Finds of Freddy's timeline? Cade went to the Pizzaplex when he was a child, and he and Selena are getting married in their 20s, I think. Regardless, this story takes place at least 2 decades after the events of Security Breach, Ruin, and Help Wanted 2. Just a funny little detail I noticed. Here's another one. This is also the first story that mentions that the Pizzaplex had various venues that kept shifting throughout its lifetime. I know that some theorists tend to use the evidence for certain venues not being present in the Pizzaplex that were in the books as evidence for how they are separate continuities. Which is fair, I mean, it's not like the games have ever implied that certain attractions in the Pizzaplex miraculously shut down and were hidden away. Returning back to our story, Cade's mother enters the room and catches Selena examining the photos. Sensing her curiosity, Janice reveals that Lally's Game held a special place in Cade's heart during his youth. She explains that Lally was an animatronic designed to be a companion for lonely children, and Cade adored spending time there. However, Janice's tone turns solemn as she recounts how Lally was unexpectedly stolen, leaving Cade deeply unsettled. When Selena broaches the subject the next morning with Cade, he only offers a cryptic response, suggesting that the incident involving Lally resulted in someone getting hurt, and he prefers not to dwell on it. In the ensuing weeks, Selena's suspicion regarding Cade waxes and wanes, ultimately dissipating after their wedding, and she allows herself to settle into their new life and move into the new farmhouse home. However, her unease resurfaces when she's working on her self-help blog, and a reader's comment on one of her posts triggers memories of Cade's mysterious trunk. Venturing into the attic, where Cade said he would put the trunk, Selena's initial search yields no results, prompting her to scour the house with a renewed sense of unease with Cade's clandestine behavior. After a thorough exploration, she stumbles upon the hidden trunk, concealed behind a veil of boxes and linen in an unused room. Armed with the tools to break the lock, she cracks it open but is interrupted by Cade's unexpected return home, right before she can creak the box open. She goes down and confronts Kate about the trunk and his earlier deception, but her words falter as Selena watches a panic flash across Kate's face upon learning that she broke the locks off the box. Rushing past her, Kate ascends the stairs in a frenzy, only to find the trunk mysteriously empty. Despite her apology, Selena observes Kate trembling in fear. He looked at her, but instead of lashing out or explaining what was missing, he enveloped her in a comforting embrace, assuring her that everything was all right. But she couldn't tell if those reassuring words were for her or for him. For a whole week, Selena would wake up to the sound of Kate frantically searching or pacing around their room. Selena heard him every time, but didn't say anything, just observed his strange and surreptitious behavior. But after the seventh night in a row with his erratic behavior, it finally prompted Selena to confront him about his new disturbing nighttime ritual. Reluctantly, without any other option, Kate opens up about what happened and what was inside the box. Amidst renovations at Freddy's Pizzaplex, a catastrophic scaffolding collapse within Lally's Blacklight Arena during a game resulted in chaos and panic. As the auditorium emptied, the attraction's mascot Lally mysteriously vanished. Or so it seemed. According to Kate, it trailed him home, haunting his every move, peering behind corners, hiding in cupboards, and following him around school. He was his favorite, and he didn't want to be alone without him. With a sense of disbelief, Selena attributes Kate's account to lingering childhood trauma, affecting his recollection of his perception of events at the time. Yet Kate adamantly rejects this notion, steadfast in his conviction regarding the reality of his harrowing ordeal. After weeks of settling in, Selena and Kate decide to spruce up their home, eventually hosting a barbecue for their work friends. But amidst the festivities, Selena's tranquility is disrupted when she encounters Lally in the garage. Lally was about 3 feet tall, and he had the appearance of a large infant. He had a white and smooth plastic shell exterior and a bald head. His appendages were petite, with joints that were a stark black. Small ears protruded from the sides of his head, accompanied by a petite nose and faintly raised eyebrows that hovered over lidless obsidian eyes. He had a subtle muscular definition that traced its way along his torso and limbs. Finally, her gaze settled on his mouth, a barely upturned curve with thick black lips. Hastening to show Kate, they both returned to the garage to find Lally had vanished. The following morning, Kate departs early to evade encounters with Lally, while Selena, unsettled by the robot's presence, attempts to do her best to push through it and ignore the animatronic wandering their property. However, a pervasive sense of being watched and eerie noises around the house plague her. No matter where she goes in the house, there's a sense of piercing eye stabbing her in the back. This persists for weeks until she seeks solace and answers from Cade's mother on Lally, hoping that she might have answers to the problems that Cade may not wish to disclose. Driving to Janice's home, when Selena felt comfortable enough to bring up Lally, Cade's mother opens up on the events that befall Lally's Blackland Arena, explaining how it was attended for only two players. Cade's fondness for the game stemmed from its exclusivity, and his fury when another child, Daniel, joined in, resulting in the fatal accident he was talking about earlier. As Selena probes for more information about Daniel, Janice deflects, whether from not wanting to answer or her older mind wavering, she couldn't tell. Instead, Janice unwittingly moved the conversation about the Lally attraction itself, specifically, the truth behind Lally's purpose as a game meant for lonely children. A detail that Kate left out about Lally was that it was merely a game of make-believe hide-and-seek. Lally wasn't an animatronic like Glamrock Freddy. It was more akin to a mannequin that kids could manipulate and pose by themselves. Children played in an isolated arena hiding Lally by themselves, and then pretending to play a game of hide and seek with an imaginary friend. Selena rushes back to her car, spotting Cade heading towards his mother's house as she drives home. Once there, she hastily packs two suitcases, intending to flee. Lally wasn't moving around the house. Instead, it was Cade moving him around like a twisted version of an elf on a shelf. Selena was about to finish packing before an unsettling noise prompted her to stop packing and listening. She couldn't isolate the source of the sound in her home. It sounded like it was coming from inside the walls, and even worse, it sounded like the tapping of baby feet waddling throughout the house. Selena succumbed to tears, questioning her own sanity, and begins to sob as she ponders how she even got to this point. As she bawls, Cade still uncovered her mouth, warning her to remain silent to avoid upsetting Lally, who he claims would harm her and lock her in the trunk. She nods nervously and notices that Cade is looking quite disturbed, almost manic, like he hasn't slept in days. When Cade lets go of her, Selena confronts him about Daniel's death, but Cade attributes it to Lally, uttering the chilling phrase, "The game is only meant for two." Filled with fear, Selena strikes Cade with a lamp in self-defense, causing him to stumble and fall. Terrified and disoriented, Selena flees towards the kitchen, only to catch a glimpse of a ghostly figure in her peripherals and Cade's movements behind her. Frantically changing course, she races upstairs, seeking refuge in the guest bedroom's closet, praying for Cade to depart, thinking she left the house on foot. Yet, her hopes are shattered when a mysterious voice whispers, "Hi," from within the closet's darkness, sending chills down her spine and eliciting a piercing scream of terror from Selena. Cade's consciousness wavers as Selena's piercing screams fill the air, eventually succumbing to unconsciousness. When he awakes, frantic panic drives him to search the house for Selena, his heart pounding with dread. He races to the guest room and discovers the trunk, his hands trembling as he opens it, revealing the grisly remnants of Selena's fate. As Cade recoils in horror, Lally's chilling slogan echoes from his mind, haunting him with the ominous reminder he spoke aloud. "The game is only meant for two." In the distant future, Cade, now remarried to a new woman named Debbie, settles into a new home with her. Exploring the attic, Debbie notices a trunk, but Cade quickly steers her away, dismissing it as a mere childhood relic. As they depart, shadows envelop the room, and two eerie pinpoints of light emerge above the trunk. Okay, so I do love this story dives into the psychological horror subgenre, a realm that FNAF doesn't typically delve into, as it focuses more on its predominant spheres of supernatural and science fiction. But as a first trek that isn't, oh, how do I put this, that puts some respect on certain Fazbear Fright stories, as a first trek that isn't batshit insane, it's a pretty good one. The story never exactly reveals whether or not Lally is actually capable of moving on its own, or if it truly was all in Cade's head, and he is simply a paranoid maniac with a severe homicidal split personality. True, that ending kind of implies that Lally probably has some level of supernatural influence surrounding it, which, on a critical analysis, I do think ruins the overall story just a little bit. Okay. Maybe ruin is a little harsh, but it does diminish the overall imaginative aspect of Lally's game that was present throughout the entire novella. The theme of the unknown is so prevalent through all three Tales books. Like, starting a new book, a new journey, or any new adventure in life, you don't exactly know what it entails, and that could be a nerve-wracking and anxiety-inducing, especially if things take a turn for the unexpected, and things get very, very off track from how you perceive the future would unfold. FNAF itself has always been the king of the unknown. By keeping its golden age games, minus FNAF 2, in a shrouded environment of ambiguity and a constant feedback loop of, ironically, not receiving enough visual feedback to confirm what's out in that pervading darkness, it is a goldmine for tension, unease, and letting your mind go wild, filling in the gaps with the worst possible scenarios. So, I have to ask, why then end with the story revealing there was some esoteric element to Lally, instead of just keeping it vague on whether or not it really was Cade or Lally who killed Selena? It just seems antithetical to the whole story structure, not damning per se, but not exactly that satisfying either. I'm not saying leave the story on the note of Cade finding Selena inside the box. In fact, the subtle implication at the end that this could be a recurring string of homicides surrounding Cade and Lally does set a disturbing precedent, which is what I think should have been the closing note that it hinged on. You may not be aware of this, but I am a man. And as a man in America, you were told to push your emotions deep down your stomach and never let those things bubble up or ever come out by any metric of the matter. That being said, I am very emotional, but not usually when it comes to pop culture, art, and media. Okay, that's a lie too, but when it comes to showcasing strong emotions, even as a kid, I barely cried when it came to television and movies. I have cried a total of 4 times in my life when it comes to storytelling. SpongeBob SquarePants Gary Comes Home, a song in which I believe it to be impossible not to tear up if you are both own an animal and have a heart and soul. Avengers Endgame, after Tony snapped his fingers and gave his life to save the universe. The movie It's a Wonderful Life. And Criminal Minds Season 1, Episode The Fox. See, the reason why The Fox was so disturbing to me, even when I watched it back in college, wasn't just because it was a story about a serial killer, but the disturbing implication it lets the audience linger on in the story's conclusion. Spoilers for those who haven't watched Criminal Minds, or for the men listening who don't have girlfriends obsessed with serial killers and are therefore forced to endure the show. The Fox can be best summarized as an episode involving the FBI trying to track down a serial killer with the family annihilator archetype. This is a serial killer that doesn't target singular victims, but instead targets entire families and kills them all. The FBI knows that this man has killed 2 families, and that he currently has 1 more hostage by the time the episode begins. Luckily, they are able to stop the killer right before he begins his ending ritual, where he kills all the members of the family he has taken hostage, one by one. They're able to save the family and trick him into admitting that he killed the other 2 families he was connected to. But that's not the point I'm trying to make here. The point is that when one of the investigators begins to search the killer's office and finds his hiding spot where he keeps his trophies of his victims, those being the wedding bands of the father/husband of the families. The story already showed us he successfully killed 2, and he recovered the ring for the family he kidnapped. So when the investigators show what he finds to the team, no one can say a word when they tilt the box open and 8 wedding bands fall out. The episode fades to black and lets your mind ponder that implication. 2 rings missing, 8 rings found. 2 families connected to the case, 6 not yet found. If this disturbs you, it disturbed me too. I went to a meeting the next day completely bewildered, as my mind couldn't fully process the implication that was being made. The effect of just leaving on a note that what we just witnessed was just a fraction of the already depraved and perverted evil we just witnessed is such a simple yet effective way to chill your entire soul. Now picture, if you will, back to Lally's game, that instead of ending on those pair of eyes above the box, it ends with the mother taking another trunk that her son dropped off and placing it in his childhood bedroom closet, absent-mindedly acknowledging, but not thinking twice, on the stack of trunks that were piled high in his closet. That opening part of the story where Selena was sleeping in his room foreshadowed that she was already sleeping in what would soon become her graveyard. Call me demented or twisted, but despite the fact that we are learning something, the unknown element of how many times this happened to Cade's Brines, nor the truth of the matter whether or not it was truly Cade or Lally, I think it leaves the audience with a much darker and more poignant note than simply a mysterious pair of glowing eyes in the shadows.
I'm crushed! You don't like the fantasy world I've created for you?
It's not real!
Are you the dreamer or merely part of someone's dream?
Alrighty. Final novella, and the first one to actually truly acknowledge the title of this series, The Tales from the Pizzaplex. And yet, we are in that building for less than 15 pages. Our story opens with Maya, Noelle, and, Jackson? Oh geez, that's a name. A group of friends who venture to Freddy Fazbear's Mega Pizzaplex to commemorate Maya's 16th birthday. Over a meal of Pizzaplex pizza, Jackson delves into a thought-provoking theory he recently encountered, quantum immortality. Rooted in the many-worlds hypothesis, this theory posits that consciousness persists across alternate realities, ensuring a form of perpetual existence. As the discussion intensifies, Maya intervenes, redirecting their attention to the Pizzaplex's new flagship attraction, an AR unit named The World Celebrates You, promising the illusion of an ideal birthday celebration where everyone in the Pizzaplex honors the user. Once they finish their pizza, they eagerly make their way to experience the immersive spectacle. If that sounds like a lot of information at once, please note all this happens in the first 10 pages. After a quick detour to a malfunctioning VR booth, which may or may not be the same VR booth fiasco we see occurring in Tiger Rock, which occurs at the same time as Nexi, which also coincides with the ending of Storyteller because Tales from the Pizzaplex is cute and quirky, Maya excitedly leads her friends to the AR unit, eager to immerse herself in the World Celebrates You experience, but is disheartened to find it closed and under construction. Maya, however, disregards the sign and enters the unit, with their friends following suit in quiet protest. With Jackon's help, Maya activates the machine, and she is instantly transported into a vibrant birthday party scene, surrounded by well-wishers, loved ones, and the glam rock band giving her special attention. Overwhelmed with joy, Maya revels in the festivities before eventually stepping out of the AR unit to rejoin her friends on the Fast Freddy ride. Given the fact this is the first story in the collection, its premise is excusable and unique. Now with the entire collection revealed, and this plot being used and copied a total of 3 separate times, I'm not even going to hide the fact that she's trapped in a VR simulation. However, I will leave you with that this time around, it's a little bit more interesting than, say, in Tiger Rock. So, let me cook. As Maya celebrates her birthday with her family the next morning, she starts to experience mild headaches where the AR headband nodes have touched her skin. By the way, yes, this book also starts the trend of the Tales books constantly swapping the terms VR and AR like they are the same thing. It's annoying, it's stupid, and I hate it, but these books are fun and quirky. Dismissing her headaches as mere coincidences, she immerses herself in the festivities, receiving a beautiful gold rose pendant from her gran as a gift. However, tragedy strikes the following year on Maya's 17th birthday, when her gran succumbs to breast cancer.
Boy, that escalated quickly.
Shortly after, her pappy is also diagnosed with brain cancer, followed by her gramps.
I mean, that really got out of hand fast.
When her nana is also diagnosed with cancer just days after Gramps and Pappy's passing, Maya begins to sense that something is amiss. At school, she notices a disturbing trend. as her classmates casually mentioned their relatives battling with cancer, showing no signs of concern or remorse, except for Maya herself. Maya dedicates her summer to caring for her ailing friends and relatives, including her own father. Luckily, a ray of hope breaks through the gloom in August with the birth of her favorite teacher, Miss Carpenter's first baby named Cecilia. When Maya and her friend Noelle visits, Maya is disturbed by Cecilia's appearance, describing her as resembling a jelly-filled, lifeless rag doll. Despite her concerns, she finds herself alone in her apprehension. Both Noelle and Miss Carpenter give the same reaction as if they are seeing a happy, healthy baby girl. That evening, Maya's world is shattered when her mother reveals her own battle with cancer. Overwhelmed and disgusted by the seemingly indifferent reaction of those around her, Maya storms off in anger. Seeking solace and understanding, she immersed herself in the news, only to be confronted by reports of countless cancer-related deaths worldwide, delivered with an unsettling air of normalcy by the news anchors. As the jelly-like entities proliferate worldwide, rapidly maturing into adult forms within the days, Maya's family succumbs to illness one by one, leaving her to navigate a world that grows increasingly bleak and lifeless. Amidst the grim reality, Maya finds solace in the vibrant hue of her gold rose pendant, a symbol of resilience and hope in the face of adversity. Yet, even this beacon of color dims as the jelly creatures multiply unchecked, their presence saturating public spaces and invading Maya's own home. Despite her valiant efforts to care for her loved ones, Maya returns from tending to her friends, Jaquan, to a devastating scene. Both of her parents have succumbed to cancer, leaving her alone to face the encroaching end of the world. With her cousins Axel and Abra refusing sustenance, Maya grapples with the weight of her solitary burden in a world on the brink of collapse. Back to Maya. Despite the obstacles of blocked roads and ominous road under construction signs, Maya embarks on a desperate mission to restock medical supplies for her ailing family. Racing against time, she navigates treacherous paths to reach the nearest chemotherapy dispensary, determined to provide essential care for her loved ones. But along the way, she encounters eerie signs of the encroaching chaos, yet presses forward with unwavering resolve. As Maya races back home, her heart heavy with the weight of her responsibilities, she encounters a scene of heart-wrenching despair. Abril, distraught and inconsolable, mourns the loss of her brother Axel, while Maya's own family teeters on the brink of collapse. But in that moment of clarity amidst the chaos, Maya grapples with the unsettling realization that the onset of calamity coincided with her departure from the Fazbear AR booth. Questioning the authenticity of her reality, she sets them aside and focuses on tending to her sister Elena's needs. As Maya administers medication to her sister and prepares to rest alongside her, their sanctuary is suddenly besieged by the relentless advance of the eerie jelly creatures. In a desperate bid to protect Elena, Maya springs into action, only to be confronted by the harsh reality of her sister passing moments before the creatures breach their sanctuary. Fleeing to the garage for refuge, Maya hopes are dashed as she discovers the creatures have infiltrated their haven, multiplying with alarming speed. Clutching her gold rose pendant, Maya confronts the overwhelming tide of darkness, grappling with the suffocating sensation of being engulfed by the creatures. But despite the overwhelming odds, death eludes her grasp, leaving Maya to ponder the chilling uncertainty of her fate. So, for closing thoughts, because I've sprinkled my thoughts throughout each story, I ended Frailty with a theorist's mindset and its overall lore implication as it pertains to the FNAF universe. I ended Lally's game with the critical mindset and how I would have improved the story's conclusion to better deliver on its psychological horror elements to fully twist the mental knife in the soul of the reader. For our deconstruction, I want to end it differently. Let's end this with philosophical Nick. You know, I really got this idea for the deeper meaning of what the story was trying to illustrate When I reread this scene where Maya watched the news and we see the anchors nonchalantly talk about the end of the world. Maya is a pretty easy protagonist to relate to at the moment because she just, like you, feels like the only person who is awake to the immense amount of suffering that is going on in that fictional world. How absolutely bloody and how fragile the current society and world status is, and absolutely mentally taxing it is to watch the collapse of civilization while civilization itself seems to be stopping to smell the roses. Thinking back to the beginning of the book, the name for the attraction was The World Celebrates You. It's a bit of a narcissistic title for an attraction, by itself a product where you can get fang applause and faux attention from the masses over being simply who you are. I'm not saying a birthday isn't worth celebrating, but how massive must your ego be if you were to believe that the entire world has to stop, look at you, and applaud you for being born? They don't know you. They don't care about you. They have their own birthdays and their own friends and families who have their birthdays. If they don't know you, they don't care about you. And from the need for grandiose applause comes a world in which it is taken over by gelatinous blobs that only barely resemble the human beings who came before, and they multiply rapidly to a point where the world soon becomes overrun with them. But they don't kill you. They simply wallow and suppress you, make you numb and feel the weight of them on top of you as you drift along through life with this pressure on you for the rest of your days. I would like to submit that Under Construction is somewhat of an allegorical tale of our current standing with the world in the digital space, especially those of the younger generation. I mean, how absolutely brutal is it? Do you ever think of it like this? How absolutely bloody brutal it is to just get hammered every freaking day on the tragedies of the world. Cancer is a tragedy. Now imagine everyone in the world getting it. When it comes to social media, the internet, news media, etc., you very rarely get that true positive feedback. It is always the worst of humanity, our worst problems and our worst disasters on full display, making the rounds directly to your eyeballs and absorbed immediately into your brain. Now imagine getting that constant feedback loop, and then you leave the digital world into the physical and real world and look around. At the very least, for most of you listening, I know that there is a difference in life circumstances for all, but I would assume for the vast majority listening right now, life is good, and the world around you reflects that. Despite the suffering you are now tuned into, around the world you still see people walking dogs down the street, going to their 9-to-5 job to pay the bills, and children playing in the yards. The world presented online towards the world you are receiving is so antithetical that you almost must feel delusional. By all accounts, the world is ending, but the reality is the complete opposite. Nobody is panicking, because the reality is the world has its problems, but they are not apocalyptic. And if you believe in that mindset, in a similar manner to how Maya is the only one who views the world as being completely obliterated, how does that make you feel? With the end of the world happening all around you, what is your plight and problems in comparison to that of the world? Like Maya, you can't even admit to your own suffering, because to admit you are in pain is an accusation of yourself and your current standings in life. There is no such thing as your own personal pain when there's so much perceived suffering around you. I see this happen in a lot of young people, especially those in high school or back in my college days. They tend to focus on the problems in the outer world from the perception of the internet landscape as a lens when they don't yet have their own house in order. Because the suffering of the world is almost a shield, a hiding place, to cower in a way. After all, you can't be seen as lackadaisical or worthless if you are perceived as altruistic for your actions. Say the right things online, People who don't even know you will like and share, and you receive the faux sense of accomplishment, even if you didn't do anything. I know I may come across as an old soul, and to be fair, despite my age, my soul is probably the resulting residue of some 1800s aristocrat or coal miner. And I don't mean to diminish those with true altruistic personalities and goals, those who run charities or donate their time for no expected gain or return but the satisfaction of doing so, but we cannot pretend that this is not a pervasive issue we can identify in people, especially online and especially very, very young. And here's the thing. When faced with a plethora of issues, most of which are considered world-ending, and with no way for one person, let alone yourself, capable of doing anything to solve these perceived apocalyptic issues, you can feel a lot like Maya at the end of the story. Alone, adrift, the world is consumed by misery while it surrounds and consumes you bit by bit. Never fully killing you, but constantly poking and prodding, reminding you of its negative presence. You know, true suffering is almost incomprehensible to those who haven't truly suffered. Not to get too dark or morbid, but those who have written accounts, sometimes from their own lived perspectives of totalitarian controlled states or abusive authoritative powers, will often mention the impossibility of living in a hellish dictatorship and communicating to that of a person who has lived into a free society, with, of course, the acknowledgement that it is actually probably a net good that we can't comprehend how horrid that life would be. The point I'm trying to make here, and I think the overall inspiration for Under Construction is that it's trying to leave the impression that there is almost a double state of being now in our world. One where we live in the real world, happy, mostly content. We have our problems, we have our sufferings, but they are manageable if we have the courage and will to solve them. And then we have the digital realm, which is a constant feedback loop of stimulating moments and the best and worst of the world with no discourse of nuance, just the extremes of all sides, especially on the political front. With, of course, you being the sole exception to the chaotic world, of course. But the more you start to live in that world, the more you start to forget reality, and soon it slowly begins to die off for you. It might start because you are legitimately convinced that if you don't do something now, the world will collapse. Or perhaps if you are truly a psychopath, you are hoping to score internet points in approval from a community for your perceived deeds and benevolence. But at the end of the day, it's all just another project. There will always be more problems, another fire to put out, because the world is not perfect. I'm not God, you're not God, and we'll never be able to carry the burden of the world on our shoulders all by ourselves. But some will continue to feign ignorance, placable in the state of things, while their true self crumbles and dries, barren and unkept, because all your focus and attention is on everything else but you. Because the world is your problem. And for those people, the world should celebrate them. And with that, I believe that brings up a good stopping point for tonight's episode. I skipped the epilogue this time around mainly because this episode was already getting very long, and also because the Mimic epilogue storyline sucks and I hate it. But it is a good opening chapter for the Stinger storyline. I'm pretty sure I actually even fully recreated it in the Help Wanted episode, so it's very good. It's a very good opening. It's a shame just ended up being, the epilogue storyline ended up just being an absolutely dreadful slog to get through. Well, thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to stay updated, please consider subscribing, following, or sharing this podcast. It truly helps us broaden our reach. Consider following us on our Twitter at Fazbear Podcast, joining our Discord, or supporting us on our Patreon or merch store using the various links in the description of this episode. As always, I have been your host, Nick, and I would like to thank you all once again for listening. Have a good night, and drive home safe.